Welcome to this edition of the B Word, where we seek to demystify everything to do with B2B branding. What is it and why it matters for businesses in growth and scale? Today, we have Richard Valtar, the founder of Muse, a staggeringly successful and extremely well thought through cloud-based property management system for hotels and other companies delivering property experiences, designed to simplify and automate operations for modern hoteliers and their guests, enabling them to create remarkable but also monetizable experiences. Richard, in my mind, is a super entrepreneur with a great story to tell. Richard and his sister imagined, created, and designed and delivered the Emblem Hotel in Prague. The idea for Muse, if I remember correctly, comes directly from this first adventure. From one install to over 5,000 of the world's leading hotels, Richard has a passion for technology and service with a desire to transform an industry with cloud solutions to make hospitality more rewarding. So Richard, welcome and thank you for joining us. I know you're a very busy man. Thank you very much.
No, thank you so much. It's so nice to see you.
Likewise. So can I just ask straight away, let's just jump straight in. So can we track right back to the beginning and that moment when you realized that check-in in all its horrors had to change for the better, and how that led to the very kind of inception of Muse? Could you share that story with us all? Because it's such a great tale, Richard.
Yeah, so the story really began with me trying to think about this hotel in Prague, which is where I'm from, and trying to really think about, you know, how can this hotel be a not just a place where tourists basically come to stay for 2 or 3 days, but how we can actually create a community of locals, community of friends, artists, you know, people that would actually kind of add to the space. And, you know, I think that, you know, in the kind of great Jane Jacobs way of thinking, you know, creating these great places, basically. And how do you engineer something like that? So at first, it really wasn't a tech project at all. It was just very much, you know, how do we design the building? How do we design the spaces? What types of spaces do we actually need for all of these different types of communities? And then it came to, you know, how do we do that at scale? How do we do that for, you know, not just the way that we would like to create that brand, but how do we actually do that for every single guest coming in so that they feel that they're actually part of this family, this community? And with that, that's when I started looking at the tech, and I had all of these ideas about how it should run and how the check-in process should run, how the communication with the guests should be, how you should feel, you know, immediately as soon as you make that booking that you're part of it. And that's when I started looking for technology and feeling that there wasn't anything that could facilitate it, any system that could run it, any system that could think like this. That's when I had the stupid idea that maybe I could just build it myself. And I got a team of programmers together, and we started building, and we started finding out that it was a hell of a lot harder than we initially thought.
Yeah, but achievable and doable. So you
achievable,
you
like it,
right?
It felt like that was the future of hospitality. It felt like this is what every single hotel aspires to. And it, you know, I think that the hotel industry, because it's become so professionalized, it's also tried to commoditize itself in some ways. You know, it's, you know, in the way that, you know, before it used to be that you would be an owner and you would, you know, you would have a special place and you would make that available to the public. And that's where people would actually kind of go. Whereas now, if you think about it, there's, you know, ownership groups, there's management groups, there's brand groups, basically, that end up, that you end up, you know, being able to borrow their logo to stick on your building. It's all very much separate. And because of that, you tend to view the rooms as the commodity that you're selling, as if you're, you know, a shopkeeper of some sort. And I think that what's nice about what technology does, and what's nice about, you know, what you can see, for example, with the rise of Airbnb and different forms of travel, different ways of experiencing the world, I think we are getting back into that world of actually, you know, it is much more about that 24-hour experience and about the communities that you're visiting, that you're not just visiting a logo, you're visiting the community that you're hoping to find, even if you're a business traveler. And I think that's something that's pervasive to travel. And I still think that all of those kind of philosophical first principles precepts that I had at the beginning of Muse still hold true today.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think you obviously saw something that could be fixed. And then it was the first port of call in my mind. If you imagine a kind of giant Rubik's cube, the first thing was like, is it about the space and how we configure the chairs and the furniture and the flow of people? And you think about UX on a very human level, like people flow, right? People journeys. And where do they pause for a coffee? And could we sell them a drink? And could they look at a brochure? Things like that. And I think you realize that technology could be an enabler of that solution. Was there a moment when you kind of knew it was going to work, when you knew you had to wrap a name and a brand around it to turn it into something that could be digested by somebody outside of your very beautiful hotel, which we visited? Was there a moment when you knew you had to do that? And was that quite an obvious moment, or was that quite a leap of faith, Richard?
I think for me, it was quite an obvious moment. It was, I don't know whether it was a lack of research or just blind optimism. I'm a massive optimist, so I never think things are going to be as hard as they actually are. And I think that helps, because that helps then imbue a sense of shame when you've got it wrong. And then that's what creates the determination to not look like a fool in front of all of your friends. And so I think that's probably how it works. It's kind of like general intellectual laziness at the beginning. And then that's followed up by just the shame of having to admit that you're wrong. And so you just bloody-mindedly kind of go through it, and you just pretend everything's okay. And this was all,
all part of the grand plan.
Yeah, exactly. But fundamentally, I think it is like, to my mind, it's still the same thoughts and it's still the same ideas. It's just the fact that I just didn't know that we would have to build such a huge company to be able to actually transform some of these things.
And what were the really early days like when you were trying to reach other hotels? I remember when we first met you, some of the people that we interviewed were in really beautiful, forward-thinking boutique, hotels, but slightly disruptive hotels, but quite forward-thinking. And now obviously you work with global chains, which is amazing. But like, what were the early days like when you were trying to reach out to people? Did you find there was an audience that understood exactly, they'd been frustrated and were thinking the same as you off the bat? Or did you have to do quite a lot of education around what you were? And did the brand help with that as well, Richard? Like, how did you get across that?
Yeah, I think, the point for me of a brand is it's something that you can hang your hat on and hang your ideas on. And I think that's why it should always be the kind of the typography, the way that you design it, the way that you think about it, the way that you think about, the taglines that go from it. It should be something that I always talk about, the idea of, you should create idioms and create idioms of yourself. And it should be something that lives inside people's heads when you're not in the room. And I think that's really, really important for a brand. Mm. And I think it's really important for, if anyone's trying to do anything innovative, it needs to be measured by the kind of the space that it creates in somebody else's head. And I think at the beginning, the only people that you're going to be able to reach are the people that are on a similar kind of wavelength. We were really, really lucky that, it just so happens that the hospitality industry does have a lot of people who want to create these great spaces, and these great places are people that really, really care about what it is that they're creating. So they understand, and they understood very, very quickly what we were trying to do. They understood why it was important that a system like ours exists in the world. And they understood why some of the ideas that weren't yet present in the system, but they could take it on trust that we were going to develop them in the future, because they felt aligned with that vision. And I think that's, to be able to encapsulate that in, in our case, a four-letter word and a logo is, I think, one of the biggest challenges. But it is something that I think every single entrepreneur has to think about, because it's that brevity of communication that you need to be able to be successful in any aspect of delivering a good product, especially one that is going to be so difficult to build over a longer period of time and going to require so many resources to be able to kind of get you there.
I think as well, like, if somebody commits to engaging, and rightly so, with what you offer, they're not just engaging with the promise of today. They're sort of engaging, in my mind, I feel quite strongly, that one of the powerful things about what you stand for as a person and how you speak about things and how beautifully you articulate some of your ideas is that you're kind of you're buying into a way of behavior and these remarkable experiences, but also the promise of what's coming next. So there's like tactical, like today you can do this, 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 this. But so much of, I think, what's powerful about what Muse has to offer is the kind of promise of what's around the corner. And this kind of, if you join us and you're simpatico to this idea of how we think about the world, then together we can do great things. I think there's something really powerful about that, that I think your brand conveys. I think that's partly your personal brand, Richard. But I think there's also about the brand of Muse conveys that too. And I think that's a really powerful thing that I think people should be quite careful not to miss when they're thinking about building their own brands as well, because that promise of what's coming is almost as important as what's there today. Because it's like, I remember you telling us it was like open heart surgery, changing a PMS system for a hotel.
Yeah. I think it's either open heart surgery or it's spinal surgery, because there are so many automatic things that happen when you're operating a kind of a central nervous system, which the property management system is. Or it's also brain surgery, because it's so much about mindset. It's about how do you approach that piece of technology and how do you approach the work that you're supposed to be kind of logging in order to, you know, show success or show progress in what you're actually doing. And I think that that's a really, really important thing. I think the one mistake people always make, and I think that this is both on the buyer side and on the creator side, is people expect things to be perfect. And I think what's important is that you start off from a good base and you figure out what are the core things that you have to have in place. But, you know, I just returned from a customer conversation. The one thing that I always say whenever I'm still pitching or doing any of these, I guess, more salesy calls, is that we are not the right system for you day one. So it's not like building a hotel where you build the hotel and it's perfect. And actually, you know, everything from there on is just going to get worse, because somebody's going to bump into the wallpaper with the suitcase. You know, that perfect thing that you created, that's just going to depreciate. With technology, it's the opposite. It's, you know, you're not perfect on day zero. And if you think that you are, then that's a mistake. You've got to be perfect for day 300, for day 600, for day 1000. And that's the way that you can serve the customer really well. And I think it's the same about the brand. I think I remember us talking about this and me always kind of going like, why don't we just go here? And you and Leah and everyone was like, well, maybe why don't we do that? Well, when we're actually doing that, you know, why don't we go into these kind of abstract forms and abstract principles later when we have a story to tell about them? And I think that that's also something that I think every entrepreneur and brand builder needs to always consider. You're an absolute master at this, of telling the right story for what is today, you know, making sure that we have enough space for what is tomorrow, but focusing in on what that story is today and how you can still leave space for tomorrow in that narrative.
Yeah, I think one of the really impressive things about what you've done as Muse is this ability to like allow the brand huge amounts of it, brand slash company, just one thing, right? You've allowed the company and the brand to stretch into these amazing events where you all dress up in pink or you wear the bellboy outfit or you're in glossy jackets, right? The brand can have a lot of attitude and a lot of fun. And then you've got the brand that's what you might buy as the Dylan Hotel in Amsterdam might have looked at the website that we all crafted with you and the brand that's there, which is much more trying to own a space that outflanks your competitors in the sense that it's understands it's about humans and experiences. But then you also have this really beautiful, you know, event that you do in Amsterdam, which is very stylish. So you've got really sexy, like hot pink, and you've got very stylish, like the Future of Hospitality event, which is now a kind of a serious event, almost a business in its own right. And then you've got a core brand in the middle that has a degree of conservatism that's right for a general manager that's looking at replacing their spinal cord or their open heart surgery. Was that quite conscious to allow the brand to stretch as much as that? Because it looks like it was. But was that quite thought through, Richard? Was that quite an intentional thing?
I'd love to say yes. I'd love to claim that I'm this intelligent. But I think at Muse, we really try and live our values. And one of them is, you know, being human. And I think it's core to hospitality. And that's difficult to achieve with technology. And with any brand that you try and create in technology, you can go, you know, super literal like Airbnb and put a heart at the end of it. Or you can start thinking about it and go, well, how can I play? How can I still remain playful whilst doing this very serious thing and being this very, you know, serious backbone? You know, because it is a very serious thing to run financial reports, to be, you know, so in the business of what your customers are doing. And I think that it's a difficult one because I'm not sure how you go about designing that. I think that you just have to, a lot of the times, it's also about how I think about constructing teams. You know, you need to have balance. And I think that that's the same thing with the brand as well, that I think that sometimes when you think about brand and the company that you want to create, it needs to have the full spectrum of attitudes. And I think the more rounded it can be, the more playful that you can be with it. But a lot of it will come just from the personality of the people that are actually helming the company itself.
I guess it's a kind of virtuous cycle, isn't it? Like you do amazing things that are memorable and talked about at a really important hospitality event. And the talent that you really want that responds to that kind of is pulled towards you magnetically, right? There has to be a courage to start that journey. And I think you've got some amazing people working in your team who are great at delivering that stuff in terms of whether it was the greenhouses or, you know, the pit stop, whatever it might be, that you've got some amazing people to deliver that. But I guess that it kind of becomes slightly self-fulfilling at some point, doesn't it? It's quite brave to do it to start with. But then as your brand behaves like that, people start to kind of, the right kind of talent starts to come to you, right? And I guess talent stays as well. Like good people stay and grow with you, right? Is that fair to say as well?
You know, there's always these studies and these things that you see about the primacy of design. And why design is so important, and why people usually equate design with prettiness, but I think it's about the way that you think deeply about delivering simple messages or delivering simplicity in itself. And I think that is one of the hardest things that you can do, both from, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're coding and you're trying to create code that's very simple, that doesn't take a lot of runtime, you know, that creates a fast, efficient system. It's the same thing with, you know, UX design and all of these things. You're trying to make sure that, especially in hospitality, somebody doesn't need to use to stay on the page for a long time to be able to do their task. And it's the same thing for example, a sales process as well. You don't want to be over talking. This is why I'm such a terrible salesperson, but you don't want to be over talking. You just want to be able to deliver a message really quickly and discreetly using the shortest amount of phrases so that the customer can really, you know, start thinking about it from their side. All of that, I think, conspires together to create creativity. And I think people are naturally drawn to creativity, and people are naturally drawn to people who are trying to express something in a simpler way, in a more truthful way, in a better way. And I think that those aspects are sometimes, you know, because they're quite soft and fuzzy, and most CEOs don't really love to talk about them because they're not, you know, they're not necessarily KPIs. But I think that the brand that you create has to have the stretch to be able to create that depth of feeling and that idea that, you know, somebody can look at your brand, somebody can look at the various totems of the things that you create around the community that you represent and go, actually, this is deep. This is creative. This is something that I can also add my brain to.
Do you find that customers that have understood that, do they almost become evangelists? Like they're part of a community now. Do they almost become evangelists for you in the way that I tell everyone to get an Apple Mac, or my friend down the road has got a Tesla and he's like, you should get a Tesla. It's just got the screen. And do people become evangelists of Muse on your behalf?
I think so. Like my personal feeling is that good brands make somebody else more interesting than they actually naturally are. So like, you know, this is how I use Muse. Like I'm fundamentally a very boring person, but Muse enables me to be interesting.
I'm not sure I agree with that, but you know.
But I think that's what it is. If there is a certain, like, people love the idea of joining a brand and that the brand is not just some kind of throwaway thing, that there is a deeper ethos to it, that there is a story that they can tell about why they're aligned with this brand, and the deeper your narrative can be, the more loyalty you engender through that process, because people want to feel that they're engaging with something that is deep, that has been thought through, that has quality to it. And I think that's why, you know, the price is always a difficult thing, but there is huge value in being able to explain why you're aligned with a certain brand.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think that pursuit, that ruthless pursuit of like simplicity is actually a very difficult place to get to. If you've done it right, it looks really obvious, but it's quite hard to get to obvious. And I think the brands that get there's no surprise that some of those brands, you know, the obvious ones, the Apples, the Nikes, the Teslas, are amongst the most successful on the planet out of this ruthless pursuit of total simplicity and clarity about who they are and what they are. I think that's absolutely right. And I think certainly from who I've met, some of the very best people that we've ever worked with and collaborated with as a design and a brand firm are at Apple. And some of the best people that I know in advertising who are old friends of mine, they're working on Nike. I mean, if good people go to good places, right? That's how it works. When we first met you, the brand was very much presented as a kind of technology. It had a particular color and screenshots, which is quite classic for that moment of time. And I think where you've got to now is very true to who you are now in terms of thinking about solving people's problems. But are there those moments when, you know, it's really obvious to you as a leader of the business with your colleagues that the brand, you've outgrown the brand, like shedding a skin? Is there a moment when you kind of know that, or is it just more instinctive and iterative? Is there a kind of a moment when you wake up and you go, gotta change it? Or does it just gradually creep up on you, Richard, I guess is the question.
Like for me now, the brand is so, the brand, I think since the moment that we worked with you, and this is not, you know, just because I'm on your podcast, but I think that there's a much better cohesion between what the brand is, what the proposition is, what the promise is of what it is that we're doing, and of the visuals that surround all of the things that we do. And I think that's a really, really difficult thing to do, because as an entrepreneur or as somebody, you know, as a small team, you're never going to get it completely right at the beginning, because you're not going to have time for all of that, because you'll be like, I'm happy just to have come up with a name, and then I have to come up with a logo that sticks in people's mind, and then I have to come up with a product or, you know, some version of how all of these things come together. And then I'm going to have to come up with a team of people that can represent all of these things. Then I'm going to have to come up with, you know, values and, you know, like all of these things that then create that cohesive whole. And it's really difficult to do that at the beginning, because you're only going to be able to be intentional about, you know, a few of those things. And hopefully you've been well-intentioned enough to make them successful. Mm-hmm. But what's great is finding that moment, and we were able to find that moment a couple of years ago with you, where we were able to say, you know, let's stop, let's take stock of what we've been, and let's just see where we are, where we're going, what we'll need to be, and let's try and prepare that groundwork. And then again, you know, in a couple of years, you then revisit that and you go, okay, well, you know, that work that we've done, you know, is that still current? But I think that, you know, for me now, it's much more about that kind of engineer's mindset of like, you know, you need to rejig it, you need to. Yeah. But I think that what was great was being able to do that foundational work of actually saying, you know, that like we are now a real company. It's not just an amalgamous blob of promise. Like we're now a real company. Let's create that foundation. And then from that foundation, you can build. And I think that that's why, you know, that's why I think that great brands settle on an identity and then build off that. You know, like, I'm not sure if the swoosh is the best thing and the best way to sell shoes, but it's something that Nike can build on. And it's something that they have used to be able to build on. And then they can be creative with it. They can do a lot of things with it. And I think that, you know, again, that came, I'd say, you know, three years into their journey. Same thing, you know, you see that ugly logo that Apple had, you know, and you look at, you know, what they then had with the kind of half eaten apple, and that becomes iconic, and that becomes the kind of, it's not just the brand mark, but it is that intention of saying, you know, this is the foundation of what we create.
I think one of the things that you've been very good at, and one of the things that Muse is very good at, is you create these moments where, you know, it might seem obvious to you that you do offsites. I see them on your Instagram feed. I love your Instagram feed, right? And you had these offsites where you will sit and pose in these chairs, right, at your offsite. But you as a management team go away out of the office to a place, a hotel, because that's your PMS in a hotel, but you go to a place to live and breathe that experience and talk about what the future is. And you'd be surprised how few companies actually take the time to do that kind of thing. And one of the common traits that we've seen of a lot of the most successful entrepreneurs that we've been fortunate enough to work with is that quite a lot of them took time to think about what they were going to do with their lives and what that mission or that purpose or that thing they were going to pick. And I also think that some of the people that we meet, you know, you included, could have done many things. It was about what you at the end settled on. So when you're in those kind of offsites and you're with the team that you've assembled around you, and I think you've got some very, very strong people around you, how do you soak in all that pressure that comes at you from sales targets, new geographies you've got to get into, we've got to do this roadmap with this new product? Like, how do you absorb all that pressure and not let, because quite easily that could be a ball flying at a window and shattering into thousands of pieces with people fighting each other to get part of resource or something. But how do you keep it all kind of steadily going in the same way, Richard? How do you manage all that?
I think to a certain extent, it gets a lot easier as you go. I think that the pressure builds in a different way. Like I always say, for me, pressure was not being able to pay somebody's salary. And, you know, when you're a team of 10, and you're looking at somebody in the eyes and you're telling them that you don't know whether you can pay them, or you have that in the back of you, that feels like pressure. You know, the fact that we might, you know, go 110% of next month's target, or, you know, 75.
Yeah.
That is a different type of pressure. It's still pressure.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel as debilitating. It doesn't feel as it goes into the realm of strategy. And there it's the pressure that I feel that I put myself under is that I never want to, at this point, I never ever want to feel surprised by anything. I want us to always have optionality. I always want us to, you know, have multiple attack vectors of how to achieve growth. I want us to feel that we are not bound to any one decision where we feel desperate. And I think that it's about, you know, creating enough of a force that you can lean into different parts to still be successful. And I think that's the pressure now. It's almost like being a quartermaster in an army, rather than actually kind of being the gung-ho captain, basically, with the sword. And I think that generally that feels like the kind of the way that companies kind of move, and you know, feeling that kind of that pressure, which is very weighty pressure, but it's very distributed pressure. you know, so that you still feel it on your shoulders, but you have so many amazing people around you, and you've built such an infrastructure around yourself and around the team that it feels like distributed pressure. And it now you're now kind of looking at like how many of these things have to go badly for us to fail,
rather than
it being real pressure, which is if I do not do this, everything crumbles, everything past, present, and future. So it's much better now.
How do you keep yourself like curious? There's a richness to the stuff that you're interested in that I think it might just come naturally because of who you are, and this amazing appetite for insight and knowledge that I know you have. But how is that a natural dynamo that you have inside you, Richard, that you've always had? Or do you actively think about things that you should be looking at and reading? Is there a discipline to your inquisitiveness, or is it just a natural fluidity?
I think on my side, it is this natural quest for inspiration that I have that I think is probably part of my personality. But the other aspect is that as we get bigger and I feel that the inspiration needs to be broader, I put more pressure on myself to kind of read like very, very widely and very, very obscure types of topics. Like I'm really, like at the moment I'm reading this like amazing book from an anthropologist. And it's just, you know, there's a tangential relationship to hospitality because it's such a, you know, hospitality is such a human industry.
Agreed.
But it's not, I'm not reading, you know, how to build great companies or how to set up a sales team 101 or, you know, how to be a little bit more like, you know, a Shopify or, you know, some of these great companies, you know, it feels now that you're trying to create a different type of magnum opus. And before you could just crib notes. Now it just gets a little bit harder. I haven't seen a book of how to build $100 billion companies, you know, from a starting point of a billion or more. You know, it just feels like there's always like this like 0 to 100 or 0 to 10, 0 to 100, 0 to 1,000. And there's huge wealth of literature there. And it's always funny that like I now get drawn to either these very obscure topics or much more around fiction than nonfiction, because it feels like that those are the parts that I need to kind of get activated, as well as, you know, understanding, you know, all the technical jargon that will need to be second nature at IPO.
So post-COVID, everything's hybrid. We work in different places. We consume things in different rates in different places. It's no longer as cut and dried as it used to be. I don't think anyone could have predicted that, but that curiosity and openness to how the world might become and just inching into that I think that's a large part of why it's going to go so well, Muse. I really do. But I also think that's part of what you've brought to the table, Richard, which is this openness to the world is changing all the time. If we lean into that change and are open-minded to it, then we can go to great places. And I think the world is leaning into what you offer in the way that you are almost a platform that could commoditize somebody's time and the space they occupy in any kind of venue. It doesn't have to be a reception or a hotel. It could be in our working place here. It could be wherever, Richard. And I think that's quite profound, actually, because most people would have missed that in a hurry to create the hotel system.
You know, I feel that Muse is in a good place because that's going to be kind of more and more sought after.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that you're describing, basically, with the kind of the post-pandemic world. I think that people do have more recourse and more technological ability to be able to work and provide value for the rest of the world in a specific way. And I know that this feels very kind of like, oh, like, you know, this is knowledge workers and, you know, what about the man basically kind of like doing. And I'm like, I totally disagree with that premise that it's only just for a certain aspect of society. Because if I look at how good AI can make you as a single person, you know, like I, you know, the, it's, my favorite example of this is, And it's a stupid example, and I realize that it's stupid, but I do think that it's telling that the most famous image that I think we've had of an AI-generated thing, and I think almost like the poster child of what AI-generated creativity looks like, was that image of the Pope in the Balenciaga puffer.
That's and right. That I remember that
created,
one. Yeah.
That was created by a part-time fireman in Michigan. So that's the premise that I use, that I then go, well, what makes you so sure that it's only going to be those one percenters, you know, in their ivory castles, basically, that are going to be driving creativity in the future? Because actually, you know, all of the studies, everything that we see is that we get to play on a broader playing field with broad-based AI. At least that's the way that I think about it.
No, I completely agree. I think I feel quite strongly that, especially as a dad, that all those professions that were based on a ring fence of you were just particularly good at memorizing huge amounts of information about a very, very narrow subject. So let's say you're the most important shipping lawyer in the country. You're probably very highly rewarded today. I honestly believe that those professions or that barrier is going to be eradicated in like 5-6 years and it's gone. There's no value to it. And I think all the clues are around us in society. I think you're ahead of that curve and have been for some time. But I think we're leaning into a society where it's going to be about the accumulation of experiences and people's imagination. And I'm now paraphrasing something you said to me a few years ago. People's imagination about what you could create as an experience. Think of Secret Cinema as an example. People's imagination of what you can create and then monetize and sell tickets for and drinks and hot dogs and burgers and a sweatshirt. That's going to be what we all spend our time on. And it's going to be a kind of Huxley vision of the future, not an Orwellian vision of the future. And I think Muse as a platform to enable that creation of these really unusual experiences that, you know, somebody imagines somewhere in Dalston, Shoreditch or Williamsburg, Brooklyn or wherever they are, that's Muse can be a facilitator and a platform to help those experiences come to life. I totally believe that. So you must have learned so much on your journey through Muse from, you know, starting out back in those days with your amazing sister and that amazing hotel and the emblem, which we went to visit before we came to interview you the first time. You must have learned so much. Like what piece of advice would you give your younger self if you could just flip back however many years it is and tell the young and very ambitious Richard, just remember these wise words?
I think the one advice that I would always want to lean into, and I think it's something that is a lifelong struggle, is just like, when in doubt, swallow your ego. You know, and I think it's the thing that everyone struggles with, because everyone's like, but it was me, or I, you know, and you kind of have to like wean yourself out of the cycle of praise, because the one thing that I think is a little bit lonely about being an entrepreneur is that it becomes very broad. And to a certain extent, it's the other way around in the way that it's represented in the media and things like that, because you're like, actually, you know, you're the great brain. And you're like, I'm not. But at the same time, it becomes difficult to feel success in yourself, because you kind of, with every mile of success, I basically just have a new horizon. I can only see what I haven't done basically right now. I always equate it back to like, you know, just swallow your ego, because actually, like, anything where you're going to try and be the front man, you know, sometimes being a front man is good because that's what people want to see. But a lot of the times it's actually taking away a potential of somebody being able to prove that they're better than you, and they are better than you. And actually that's a gift, being able to actually surround yourself with people that are better than you. But you do hire yourself out of that job and out of the responsibility so much of the time that it can feel difficult from that perspective.
I think if you can lose the ego and you can lose that sense of the I and the me, and you can be open to the sort of the influences and the waves and the societal tides and changes and be aware of that. You could be phenomenally successful, which ultimately is what the ego is driving you to, without that ego dragging you down with it. And I think that's absolutely right, Richard. I just finished reading an amazing book by a guy called Yvon Chouinard. I can't really say his name properly, but he's the founder of Patagonia. Mm-hmm. And he's written a book called Let My People Go Surfing. And very like you, he created a business to create climbing equipment because you like going climbing. So you've created a business to make hotels better because you had a hotel with your sister, which is a beautiful hotel, but it could have been better. And then to his surprise, if you read the book / horror, lots of people would wear it just around the street and wear his jackets and gilets, and some of them in the city, and wear them all. And he was like, he went with it because he was about, well, that means they go outdoors more, than I'm happy, right? And I think that's your hospitality moment, that moment as Patagonia stops just being on the mountain, but is in the high street and everywhere else. And then he went one step further with that core idea and created 1% for the planet, which is this amazing movement about giving back pre-B Corp to save what's around us, because ultimately he was about climbing a mountain. So that's his truth. I think you're on that same journey, Richard, of you did something for a reason. It's gone wider and can go wider, and that's where we're at now. And it's going to lead somewhere else, Richard. So I'm really excited to see where that is, and I'm going to stay attached to see where that goes. But it's been amazing talking to you. I can't thank you enough, and I'm a huge fan.
So
I can picture you and Matt ringing the New York Stock Exchange. I had a vision of it. I told Leah. So it feels New York, not London. But honestly, thank you so much, Richard. I can't thank you enough. It's been fantastic talking to you. We should start our conversations again on phone every now and again.
Yeah, definitely.
So thank you.
Thank you so much. See you soon.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join us next time on The B Word.